Hey everyone, welcome back to RZ 2 Cents. It's been about a month and quite a bit, over a month, I think. It's the second, if not the longest separation between two RZs on podcast in the RZ 2 Cents history, which officially going to be 2 years old in a month. So we started the end of October in 2018, and now it's 2020. Mm-hmm. So, been 24 months, and we still produced about, I think, 40 episodes. So we definitely did way more than one episode per month, right? 24 months, about 40.
Oh, episodes. Definitely more than that.
Yeah. So just, you know, little milestone on the way, and we are proud of our accomplishments, I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So
time flies.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So now I'm talking to you guys from my San Diego, California home, and Roy is actually back in China. You know, quite a trip from Vancouver and to be back in China and have to quarantine and do all that. So I'm sure that's an interesting aspect. So today we would like to – this actually during the pre-podcast session, Roy and I have discussed what the topic. We definitely want to touch on what seems to be our audience most interested in, the economy and how the world just basically things are moving and things that relate to business, to capital. But also, I just thought about something else that I kind of want to touch on as well, is that I was reading – this is kind of deep. I guess we'll touch on it at the end, but it's just something profound that my thoughts kind of all came together while I was I took a 20-day vacation in August, by the way, and then while I was on vacation, and also I reread the 12 rules of both our favorite books, and rule number 7 was don't pursue an expedient life, but pursue a meaningful one. That's the rule number 7, I believe. So actually, from that standpoint, I sort of want to elaborate on that and how I've been thinking about not necessarily the meaningful life, we did that already, but more of, you know, what are the things that truly matter in life? And sometimes we lose perspective. I do feel like this is a need, let's say, at least refresh that once a year on a podcast. I mean, I do that for myself once a month, just to refresh what things are truly important. And I'll give you guys the background story why I've been thinking about it while I was on vacation, because how things, you know, personal life had changed a little bit this year, and things, certain things accelerated, certain things happened that made me rethink about this. I do that every year for different reasons, but I'll tell you guys the reason this year. So anyway, that's sort of where we want to be. So both part of the economy, and then we'll touch a little bit on philosophy at the end, if that's okay with you.
Sure. Yeah. I'd be happy to.
So we will start by talking about it. So anything that you have noticed from your travel, from your, you know, either Canadian or China or everything else, with the economy and things like that. Anything you want to mention, anything you want to bring up, or any questions you want to throw out to audiences to think about, anything like that, Roy?
Well, I guess I've been, compared to you, I've been more, you can say, on the ground, because I've been moving back to China. And just experiences on the ground, it's just like China is pretty much back to normal. Pandemic seems to them like a topic of the past already. People are not really talking about it anymore. And, some are worried about, you know, a resurgence during winter, but, most are very confident, like highly, highly confident in the government's ability to, combat and control, have their virus come under control. And, this whole process of coming back, being quarantined, it was a very, very well designed, systematic, and highly efficient process. I was actually quite impressed with the ability. It just seems quite difficult, you know, to have everybody go through multiple stages of testing, everybody recorded, the information recorded, temperature check twice a day, and then this health code that records where you've been. And it's just a very systematic and efficient approach. So it just shows the, I guess, the strength of the Chinese system during special times. Yeah, that's that. These are some of the things that the biggest differences I've seen on the ground. Yeah, I hope more countries adopt, can learn something from what China is doing. You know, be there. You know, there are political differences, but this we can all try
absolutely
to learn from.
And just,
at least China has more experience.
Yes, and I think
with it right now.
You can relate that to even. I read this actually. You can see the resemblance after I give the example. I think even though it might sound quite strange, you can relate to this to 12 years ago. The strength China has shown on organizing a almost perfect, or if not the best, Olympic experience for the world. That compared to, if you think about 2018 Olympics, right? I mean, I was younger then, obviously. I went with my dad, went to the opening ceremony. It was amazing. Tons of, I mean, the most foreigners I've seen in China, obviously, growing up in 2008 in Beijing. Now, I grew up in Shenzhen, but still the most foreigners I've seen, even though there's foreigners around always, even when I was a little kid. But anyway, and that was quite amazing with how, basically, if we summarize it, is that how Chinese people can, the government and people themselves, they have to be willing to be organized as well. How the government can organize such a huge event that they can be so cohesive. We're talking about, we're not talking about 5,000 people. We're talking about, you know, 400,000 people, from a granular scale point of view. And there's more than 100,000 volunteers and other members and workers and just managing how the whole cities go. Or let's say if you look at the taxi companies, right, during that time, each, it doesn't matter, private, public, whatever, they follow the city of Beijing's code and to, you know, pick up, you know, arrivers or travelers or foreigners from the airports or people travel domestically to come to see all the games. It lasted for a month. And like even the taxi drivers, they had a sense of pride. I remember back in 08 was that, okay, it's my job now to show everyone the world what China is about and what Beijing is about. Literally, you know, like in Chinese, they're saying, you know, like, 我们要欢迎他们来北京, you know, it is their, they feel it's their honor to do so.
Welcome and, people to Beijing.
Exactly. And obviously that's quite a moment, especially for Chinese people to put themselves on world stage, right? Because we look at 2001 was the joining WTO and 2008 was the sort of the globalized moment with, you put down, you know, everyone was watching the Olympics.
Yeah.
So, that kind of organizational skill, I think, displayed even more during crisis, right? Because that was something to celebrate. But this is something to be, you know, you have to deal with. It's a crisis. And I think besides the initial delay or the initial sort of a lack of efficient response by the regional government in Wuhan, but after that, like as far as central government-wise, like say if you enter Shanghai or enter Chengdu directly, like say if you enter the Chengdu,
Chengdu,
like, doesn't matter which one, they have there's such a cohesiveness about it, right? Like people who check you in literally at the airport or give you COVID test,
and everybody was obeying.
There's no question.
You know, there was no,
exactly,
nobody
asked,
challenging.
No question asked,
this
and
process.
Then you just obey. You know, you process the. You basically, you know, you have your COVID test, you're right. Yeah. Cause I have a conference I've gone through. I guess I sort of know, even though I've been through, like, you know, you go through COVID test, then you check in the hotel, then you, there's separation. You cannot see you. Even if you travel with your buddy, you cannot see him in his hotel room. You gotta, you know, you separate it. And then every morning, there's people coming to check your temperature, right? At 9 o'clock or something, right? People come in, check your temperature twice a day, right?
Yeah, twice
so
a day.
You theoretically, you cannot get a fever, even a regular fever during that time. If you do, you know, they don't know if it's regular fever or what. Then you don't leave your hotel room. You don't live in your hotel room anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky that my hotel room had had a AC on. We could use the AC.
Nice.
We could order takeout, a delivery, and then we can order packages from online. And then from what I heard, some hotels don't let you do that. Some hotels don't even let you turn on the AC because they think AC spread air from room to room. So if one person in one room has it, the whole hotel has it. So, and the people, the employees, I really appreciated working at the hotel. They were wearing full-on protective gear every day. And it's just hot and sweaty in there.
So,
you know,
so overall, so overall,
pretty,
it's
pretty difficult.
The cohesiveness is it's amazing, and when it's orchestrated by the government, obviously in the right way. So, I think that's something to be touched on. And just maybe one more on that. It's, I think it has to do with I think mainly two things. One, I think lower labor cost is one, but you know, you can argue Africa has lower labor cost, Brazil has lower labor cost, or you know, emerging countries. India has lower labor cost.
India has lower labor cost.
It's mainly the culture where people have to dive into Chinese culture. Is that there was always an emperor, there was always a king, and it's always China. It literally means you know center of the world, kind of. That's the definition of the country. So they always the people who rule the country always feel like Putin之下莫非王土, you know, like everywhere it's mine in this country. So that center, highly centralized authority runs through. And in many ways, definitely, you know, there are benefits to it. Because like we've talked about, 08 and 2020, these are the two biggest events I can think of. You know, one thing you want to celebrate, you want to do it very well. I mean, you can do a – here's the thing, though. These things, like, if you can do a you can do a crappy job of hosting the Olympics, people won't really – you know, they won't really remember it or talk about it that much. It's a celebration, you know, it's not as good a celebration. If you do good one, people remember it for a long time, sure. And if you do a bad job doing crisis, people, even if people don't criticize as much now, I think history will have a fair judgment of, okay, what could have been done? That was a horrible decision. Like, say, the two wars, right? But at that point, I mean, or it's three wars, actually, by old Bush, one of them, you know, in the Gulf War in the 1990s, like, people were sort of okay with it then. What if Vietnam War? Let's go back even further, right? If we go through American history, like people sort of, well, Vietnam War, there's a lot of protests, obviously, but you know, there's still people who are okay with it. But later on, the more it went on, the more people realized it was a mistake, right? So I'm saying, basically, I'm saying that history will have a final judgment, final word to say, okay, if you really messed up, like say now people might not give this current administration that much heat. Like some people definitely do, some people don't, how this pandemic went, for the US or for, you know, for other countries who didn't manage well, who for whoever. And, but I think 5, 10 year, 20 year, when people write history book, there will be sort of a fair assessment of what's going on. So that's where the judgment comes in. That's where your legacy is. So I think, I think with time will tell, but my hunch is that, the countries who, didn't, not just the U.S., but the country who didn't manage it well, I think they'll be remembered because of the crisis that didn't manage well. And they're, you know, and many people experienced those like us in our early part of our life. When we turn 40 years old, we're going to look back and be like, okay, you know what? We will remember that. We went through that. And that was the country we did very well. This is the country we didn't do well. So that's that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think going back to your point about China, I think China has always been more collective as a culture. And in Confucius' ideas, you know, individuals serving a family, serving a state has always been part of the core of the culture. I guess it's all you and I, we've been both been, have experienced the education system in China, right? And if I remember correctly, back in elementary school, we were asked to sit in the same certain way, like the whole class. And to move in cohesive manners. It was much closer to military compared to education in the States, for example, right? I think a military environment will be the opposite of a creative environment. So there's obviously been critics of people critical of the Chinese education system not being creative enough. But in terms of discipline, and serving in one collective goal, I think it does a very good job. So I guess the education system also plays a role. People are trained in a certain way from a young age to be able to do that and to be able to understand the importance of
it. I agree.
Yeah. And I guess going to your point about history making a judgment, you know, in terms of the current situation, China is handling better. But who's to blame? I think oftentimes, you know, in Chinese, there's a saying, history is written by winners, right? Those in power. So oftentimes it's influenced by power, right? So, I mean, we're seeing with the Trump administration, they're throwing blames at China. So it's tough to say because this situation, we're hearing this situation because of a vulnerability, I guess, in the Chinese system. But China grew out of it because of the strength of the Chinese system, right? So it's characterized by both.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm saying, I agree. And I think over the longer term, people will look at it, at least hopefully, I would say written by winners, but also rational in many ways. Like say, you know, like George Bush, sure, two wars, he was okay president, but you know, later on people, America won. I mean, there's no way you can say Iraq won or Afghanistan won, right? But there was huge cost. Now people look back, be like, okay, that wasn't really that smart. Or the Vietnam War, right? People saying like it was, yeah. It's not like the Vietnam, you know, beat the U.S. But people saying,
yeah,
people are still at least in Western, you know, media or style of thinking, they will criticize the past. They were saying that's not right. Or Germany, they will say that's more obvious thing that,
well,
you know, the Holocaust
I guess,
right. Even if, yeah.
Well, I guess the one big difference is by now we have so much more information communication technologies. So information gets out easily. So it's much more difficult to paint the truth in a certain way. Even though it still gets painted.
Compared to like 15th century, for sure.
Tough to reverse. Yeah. Yeah. Then it was just like whoever could write, you know, it was their subjective ideas implemented.
Yeah, that I totally agree. Yeah. If it were 15th century, then it would be much more winner biased, like much, much more than now. Now it's still definitely winner biased, but might be a little bit more objective and depends on who, you know, which country has a specific situation, but definitely much more transparent now than before, where transparency doesn't really guarantee objectivity, but it's close. It can help. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 100%. And I guess another difference I suspect is that how people feel, right? Because going back to the how people feel about the economy, let's say if China and the U.S. are both in a pretty tough situation, I think the people's crowds, psychologically speaking, people will feel better or be more confident about the outlook of the economy because life feels back to normal. You know, even if it isn't, you know, even if the economy, let's assume, is pretty bad, but just having a normal life numbs people's view of the future, I guess, right? Versus in the U.S., people are stuck at home. It's, I mean, literally right in your face every day that this isn't normal. And this is reminding you every day that this is going to have huge impact on your country. So that probably plays a difference.
Totally agree. And how are the biggest events in China? Are there like sports games still without fans? Because U.S. actually back to pretty normal now. I think the results, I would say, are different is that people realize people who go to school, they Zoom classes all day, no campus. People who have big events, conferences, stuff like that, cancel. There's no business conference traveling like a expo or CES next year. CES next year is even virtual because it's January 2021. And CES, I went last year, but, you know, it's in Vegas. It's like the biggest electronic event in the world, but canceled. Virtual. That's the difference. Well, now is, Hey everyone, welcome to RZ Two Cents. This is the second welcome in the same episode because we had a little technical difficulty, so we had to actually pause the recording on one day, and then here we are 24 hours later and figured out the difficulties, as everyone experienced some sort of technical difficulties these days via Zoom meetings or cloud computing or whatever, as everyone works from home now virtually. Here we are back at it. This is considered the second half of the same episode.
Yep. So yesterday we were talking about the COVID response differences between U.S. and China.
That's right.
And how people feel about the outlook of the near future. So has anything changed in the past, I guess, a month and a half since our last episode? In terms of your outlook of this pandemic, your outlook of the next near 2 years of our world?
Yeah, that's a great question, Roy. Actually, that's something I definitely want to touch on. And if for some reason, just for the ones who listen to the previous parts, we don't get to that
the meaningful life part, look for a meaningful life but not an expedient one, we will move that to the next episode. It was a regarding Jordan Peterson, which is a great philosopher that we both like. In case we don't get any time for that. So, regarding the economy where we are, I think that was a great question. I do want to emphasize this point that I think I accidentally, not purely accidental, but I wasn't sure about, I wasn't 100% firm with that view. Now I'm more and more firm with that view, and I want to reemphasize it as sort of my opinion toward how it's going to play out with the COVID-19 pandemic, especially regarding the economic situation and market developments. Remember back in May when we had a couple episodes regarding COVID? You and I discussed, I expressed the view that March was time to buy, right? And we'll see a big run up. And around May, I placed a view that this is not actually a complete turnover kind of crisis recession. We'll actually come out of it pretty strong. And then we're going to see in 2022 or 2023, you know, around that time frame, well, maybe even 5 years, 2025, I would say maximum, to see a debt bubble burst. That will be an economic recession. Remember that view?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
So basically, this is just a blip. This is actually a expansion that's continuing from 08. Then we're just, you know, having a super long cycle. And the actual debt cycle comes first, you know, and things go down like severely.
Yep.
And
this is a delay.
Exactly.
Delay of that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I want to reemphasize, I'm 100% on board with that view now.
100%. Okay.
Yeah. So
what has solidified your confidence?
Exactly. So a couple of things, right? So let me address, let me just, you know, again, address that view completely. Then let me tell you what the reason behind it.
Sure.
So that view is, basically, I think you guys can find, I'm going to do this just real quick right now. To see if you guys can, I think it was one of the episodes we did. I'm pulling up our RZ 2 cents.
I think one of the first episodes we did after the stock market crash.
Yes. Probably the second one or something. We did something on the March. Okay, ready? So on February 3rd, we did six principal decision making. That was before COVID. March 6th, we did intense discussion on coronavirus and its impact on three levels. Then March 19th, we did economic shutdown opportunities in a recession. And April 26th, we did COVID-19 economic impact on opportunities in recession 2.0. I think it was either one in March 19th or the one on April 26th, 2.0. Either one, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then after that, we dive into, you know, we were doing civil rights and stuff. So anyway, the point I made then and the point I'm thinking now is that because this cycle is so – It's so different. That was just my hunch, sort of my intuition then. I could be proven wrong at any point, so I wasn't really 100% sure. I was sure about that was a time to buy, and that was a overreaction to a human health crisis that shouldn't have been taken lightly. Basically, my view was that the human health crisis should be taken more seriously, right? Governments should be, the U.S. should be more efficient, right? However, the financial markets overreacted, and lots of assets were very cheap, and it was time to buy. And so far, I've been proven right on that front. But the second point of view I was making was that this is not a turnover recession. It's a blip, or let's say, a stepping stone, or more of a just a speed bump. Let's look at it more of a speed bump that we're going through in the cycle. We will end the cycle some point, a couple years later. And now, what's actually solidified that view even more, I'm very sure about it, is that a couple of things have happened that I didn't even expect coming out of March, and I don't think anyone did. Was that there are many sectors of the economy are actually strong, surprisingly strong, and it's very weird in a way. One is that the housing market is super strong. Housing prices are highest since 2007, 13 years. People are moving everywhere. Real estate agents are making lots of money. Furniture sales are through the roof. Home Depot, Restoration Hardware. You know, Restoration Hardware is a company we're talking about selling $10,000 couches, right? And $3,000 lamps. So these are high-end furniture units that are moving quickly, right? That's one. Second, if you look at companies like, say, the automotive markets, it's used car prices are sky high since 2011, so 9-year high. These data you can find on, CarMax and other places, like used car prices are very high. And So people are buying, obviously this is understandable from a transportation standpoint. Some people who used to commute via public transportation, now they use private ones because, you know, worry about COVID, stuff like that, blah, blah, blah. And you know, people have that, who want to switch car, they're doing it now. And third, recreational spending on, let's say, recreational usage, like things like, say, mountable boats. It's a public trading company. You guys can actually find the information there. The boats, jet skis, yachts, those things are selling off the roof. During recession, it doesn't happen like that. But this summer, you know, because the you know, I guess for that class of people who used to travel abroad, go to Greece, and, you know, or Mexico, or whatever, but they're not doing that, they get a new boat. And we're not just talking about exclusively, you know, the upper class. We're talking about, you know, middle class, you know, because some of the boats are selling for 20 grand, some people think, you know, you can get a jet ski for $9,000, things like that. So those things are selling off the roof, right? And typically, this is, and also last point, that consumer credit is pretty healthy. This is public information as well. You can kind of look at JP Morgan credit card delinquency data rate. They publish that as a public information for looking to that. Citibank published their data, their credit card delinquency rate. They're both right around like 1.6%, 2%. It was just pretty normal compared to before, right? Mortgage deferral rate, right? Mortgage delinquency rate is steady as well, right around 4%. So deep. So we're seeing from all sectors of the economy, especially the reason why I mentioned houses and vehicles, because these are big ticket items, right? These are not, you know, a quick decision. You just buy something cool on Amazon that costs you $25. These are big ticket items that are well thought out decisions. People clearly have the budget to spend and doing it. So this brings basically a couple of things to mind. Is that one, definitely the medium to lower part of the economy is being supported by the government stimulus checks, right? There was a one-time $1,200 to each individual who doesn't make $100,000 on their 2019 tax returns. There was a $600 a month, I mean a week, $600 per week, so pretty good income for people who claim unemployment, right? And they were at the peak, it was about 20% unemployment, right? So with 400 million people, we were looking at around 70 million, like, you know, people unemployed. Now it's about 10% unemployment, right? So I think now it's lower. It's like about 28 million people out of jobs. But, you know, they were able to collect that $600 per week check all the way through July 31st. So, you know, after throwing all those numbers out there, basically the picture now is that in a typical recession, housing market is not that strong. All the markets completely goes to the tank. But these things are actually doing well. People who were basically quarantining through that March April period. Now we're like so many months away from that. They were out and about in May, June, mainly July. They were everywhere's out and about. There was a kind of a second wave thing in the southern states, in Texas, Florida. We're talking about that early, you know, June-ish, after they opened very early and people were very aggressive with showing public without masks and stuff like that. Then now people wear masks and people are out and about. So this cycle, from a consumer standpoint, it's just very different. And from a corporate spending cycle, obviously, the Federal Reserve, because they print a lot of dollars, you know, literally just print the money during that time, and because saved lots of distressed debts and junk bonds, and then corporates were in debt trouble, right? But the rate today, because they dropped interest rates so low, right? So the rate they're getting is insane. You can find these two stats very interesting. Is that if you give the best of breed companies, they're able to borrow for free and they can grow even better if they are good capital allocators. That's what makes the best companies even scarier. Like, remember this? Apple were able to borrow a loan, okay? They don't need it, by the way. They have $250 billion in cash on the balance sheet. They don't need it. But they just did it because they can. They borrowed about another $20 billion, okay, from lenders for a 0.125 rate, okay?
So lower than Treasury.
Yo, definitely. Treasury is about 0.6 right now for the 10-year. Yeah, for 10 years. 2 years, probably about 0.2, 0.3. So for the lower treasury, so 0.125, like, you know, basically 0.1% rate for a that loan, the principal is not due until 2030 on a $20 billion loan. You might be asking, well, who loans money out like that? There's no return, right? You just get a principal back. Apple will pay you back guaranteed, almost, right? Unless they go bankrupt in 10 years. And then, but where you get zero return, it's like 0.1%. Because there's lots of insurance companies, there's a lot of reinsurers, there's a lot of pension funds who want absolutely safety of capital, and they want some kind of return that's more than 0% interest rate to get at a bank. So 0.1 is better than zero, right? So Google were able to borrow at 0.25 or something percent for like another 20-30 due loan. You know, that's like around, you know, it was like $5 billion or $8 billion, around that little under $10 billion range, right? So, and for the distressed industries, right, the rates are not low. However, just two examples real quick. One example is public, actually, so they would get a lower rate. Otherwise, they would be like the second one. The first one is Wynn Resort. Wynn was getting a 7.5% interest rate for about, I think the payment's due 2026, right? So they can, you know, the casinos need a lot of fixed costs. They're trying to shore up the balance sheet and weather the storm. They did that in April. And Airbnb did a loan about 11%, right? That's, you know, from a debt insurance perspective, that's a decent reinvestment. But Airbnb is private. They're able to, the ability to able to tap into capital markets. The functionality is different. So they got 11% from Silver Lake, which is another private equity group, back in April for 11%, and I think it's payable in 2025. So the point is, on the corporate side, that is accumulating. It was the highest level before COVID, like 2019. December 2019 was already very high for corporate debt. Just the interest rate was relatively low. It was 2% interest rate, okay, the Federal Reserve rate. And most corporates getting bonds probably has 5%, you know, 6, something like that, right? Since Federal Reserve dropped it, now the good companies are getting something that definitely lower than 1%. And the companies were distressed. If they're in a normal interest rate environment, Wynn Resort probably have to get like, you know, 12% interest rate. Airbnb probably have to get 18, right? Or Delta Airlines, or let's talk about American Airlines, probably have to do about 25% interest rate to be able to borrow anything. That means they won't last long and they will go bankrupt. But especially for the airlines. But now since Treasury dropped the rate and they print a lot of dollars and they're buying corporate bonds, so that helped because they're saying, you know, this is a not human-made error thing kind of thing. This is a basically not these companies' fault that the government willingly shut down, so they will take the responsibility to help them out, to not have the economy collapse. Obviously, these companies are major employers, right, to hire people. Now we're accumulating a huge bubble, I think, in the corporate debt market. And these companies aren't. There's a famous thing by Howard Marks, which I love a lot, is that capitalism without bankruptcy is like religion without hell. Doesn't work. You know, I'm sure you've heard of that. Capitalism without bankruptcy is like religion without hell. Because if you if you have a religion, you have people believing it. You have to have hell, right? Like it's gonna. Otherwise, people, you know, like people who really believe in a religion, they'll be, oh, if I do this, if there's something wrong, something evil going, I'm gonna go to hell, right? I'm not gonna do that. Right? So that's the discipline. That's the ultimate punishment in religion, right? That's like capitalism without bankruptcy. But now we have admitted lots of bankruptcy. Not all, but a lot. So I think as the, so basically you look at it this way. I'm going to put it in even more simple terms. Like imagine, your left hand, if you put it up, it's money printing, right? So for now, everything looks to be soft, okay? Money piling up, everybody, just liquidity everywhere. It's just you know, people are able to have easy access to money. You see that in the stock market, right? So there's money printing that seems like, because they printed more, so there's more people be like, okay, you know what, lending $2 billion to Delta Airlines, fine, you know? Okay, so, but on your right hand, it's ultimate productivity and ultimate demand. Is that at some point, if the economy, let's say by a normalized term in 2022, unable to absorb or to be able to, people unable to keep the spending or things are unable to produce a certain amount of productivity, then eventually the returns will not be there. Like now companies
will catch up to you.
I'm sorry?
It will catch up to you.
Exactly, it will catch up to you. Exactly, yeah. I thought you said I broke up again, so I worry about technical. Okay, yeah, good. So it will catch up to you. And the last point to have everyone understand is that what happens is that I'm not – like there are – if you know, people are going to be asking, okay, what is – then are you saying the stock market is overvalued? Are you doing this? No. It's – stock market, one, is that for value investors, Warren Buffett talks about all the time. You don't – you know, we try not to speak about the stock market. We talk about the market of stocks. Because they're different companies, right? So, but any given moment, there's overvalued companies, there's undervalued ones. Anytime, any second in history. So, and now is that I think the companies who will not be able to produce, because these days they're valued, let's say, at 25 times 2021 earnings, right? So guess what happens if they do meet that goal in 2021? They're justified. And they, if they're growing, they can get 30 times earnings, yeah. right? What happens if they are modeled at 25 times 2021 earnings and 2021, they don't come through? Guess where they're going? They're going down. So, and going down quite a lot because now they're already at 25 times 2021 earnings. So that's my worry is that the industries who are not able to transform themselves well, or just bad business, or business with bad competition landscape, or whatever reason, right? That's much more complicated to dive into. That's what we spend most of our time on. Will have their truth, even though it's delayed, their hell to be, you know, to for lack of a better word, they will come to their hell when the time comes. It's just delayed. And I think when that time comes, you know, I would say, yeah, we can have this recording on this day, and then we'll mark it.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, again, hopefully,
yeah.
I think the latest 2026, that's the latest, 6 years from now. That's already a very, I would say, conservative projection. I think it will be earlier than that.
And the latest, okay.
Yeah, latest 2026, I would say.
Well, do you have an earliest estimate?
No, not before 2022. Yeah, not like in a year.
Okay.
Yeah, not in a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So essentially, what you're saying is the trend in the corporate debt market that was already in place before the pandemic hit has been worsened by the pandemic, essentially.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
It has been delayed but worsened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. So there's one part of it that I'm not quite sure about. So what do you think is the biggest factor that has caused this new, state in the corporate bond market? What's the biggest factor?
So you're saying what's the biggest factor of that many issuance or these companies, whatever?
Yeah, that many issuance.
Okay, so because they need more money to survive, right? Because they have less income now.
Yeah.
And some of them...
You mean before the pandemic?
Oh, you're saying what caused the corporate debt market problem before the pandemic?
Yeah, before the pandemic.
Okay. So before the pandemic, let's push ourselves back to a December 2019 then. Okay. So on March 2020, we know why they need more debt, right? That's easy, right? Because they need to survive. Okay. On December 2019 and before that, if we move back 18, 17, 16, go back. Why do they need it? Basically, it's the Federal Reserve again because their interest rates were low. Out of the financial crisis, they were way too late to raise interest rates. It was always at 0.75, 1%, whatever. Obama had one of the greatest stock market run in history during his presidency, from 2008 to 2020, to 2016, those 8 years. I'm not, this is not a political comment. It has less to do with him, more with Janet Yellen, which were the Federal Reserve chairwoman back then, was that, they didn't raise rate above 1%, like the Federal Reserve funds rate, like your savings bank loan, your savings bank account rate, didn't go above 1% until like 2015. So, and that was 7 years past the crisis already. And then 2016, boom, 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 they raised one. Then Trump came up, had a tax cut. Then 2017, they raised it four times. 2018, they raised it one time again, get to 2.25%. And last year, they raised it one time, got it to 2.5%. Okay, so, but a normalized rate environment, let's say, a lot of people talk about internet bubble and like 1999, stuff like that, during that time. During 1999, when it's the greatest bull market ever, or turned out to be, too much of an overshoot, become a bubble, then burst. But before that, was one of the greatest bull markets during Bill Clinton era, from 92 to 99 to 2000, was that the interest rate, even at the peak, was at 6%. So if you put your money in the bank, you get 6% immediately. You get 6% a year. That year. So if the stock market is overvalued, there's nothing to go, right? There's a clear alternative you can put in the bank. And inflation were running, reasonable, not too hot at 3.5, right? So your real return is at 2% if you just, very risk averse and want to put your money in the bank, right? But now what happens is that no matter where inflation is low right now, like 1.6%, 2%-ish maybe. Core CPI is like about 1.6. So, but no matter where inflation is, if your real rate is zero, if your rate turns zero, you put cash in the bank, you're losing money, right? So, for all those years, was because the corporate debt issuance, to answer your question directly, was because those money had to find somewhere to go.
I see.
They had, because if you were in the bank, they were earning, or the treasury basically same rate at the bank, right? They were earning 0.75, 1.5, whatever, losing against inflation. And those pension, if you look at this, one of the biggest cap pension fund in the country, like California State, you know, the public state pension fund, I think it's like $40 billion, right? Their targeted goal is like 7%. Or Sovereign Wealth Fund, like Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund, like their international fund, or Singapore, right, Sovereign Wealth Fund, their target rate return is like 6%. Where can you find 6%? Corporate bond. Because AT&T can issue the bond. Barry, AT&T is actually heavily in debt. I don't think the company is going to have any problem because they have such a big business. But, you know, they just take up way too much debt. It's very interesting. You look at even companies like AT&T overall. Because they can, during those low-rate environments. But if rates goes up, it's going to be hard for AT&T even to make their interest payments. So they are – but companies like AT&T can issue a bond of like 5.5%. That fits exactly where these pension fund insurance, you know, and these big money, where do you want to allocate? Because stock markets, to them, they have equity allocation already. Typically, it's high. It's like 40%, 50%, whatever, already. So, but, you know, they don't want to be 100% in your stocks because it is volatile, right? It's definitely more volatile than corporate bond, right? Because you get interest payment every month, right? And then at a certain point, your principal gets paid back if the company doesn't go bankrupt. So that sounds like a safe investment. You know what I'm talking about? Like, say, that gives you 5.5% to borrow to AT&T. They pay you every month. And if AT&T doesn't go bankrupt, you get your principal back. Would you say that's a pretty good investment to you?
In a company like AT&T, sounds pretty good.
Exactly, right? And, and if you have a high, let's say if you're a big money allocator, let's say if you manage your family wealth and you need like $30 million to be somewhere, you can't have the $30 million, okay, to be in the bank. Producing zero, but you don't want to be the only stocks. You have to put it somewhere. Would you say that's somewhere you want to go? So that's answering your question. You know, that's literally how it
works.
But everyone's up there. That's the problem. So
I see. Okay. So were this to happen, obviously we're going to have another recession. Let's say we get another recession before 2026. What weapons do the Feds have? And will the old weapons still be as effective? If not, what do you think that they're going to do to save the market, to recover from this recession?
Yeah, here's the thing. If it was U.S.-centric, it was very, very bad. It was structural. No matter what they do, certain things have to happen. Like, certain companies will have to go bankrupt. Just as simple as that.
Okay.
The company will move on, like Ford. I used AT&T as an example. They're managing it. They're okay. Remember I said Ford now. Kohl's. Kohl's is a retailer. There's a bunch of department stores. You've probably seen it around the highway. They sell, you know, just all kinds of things, but they're retail stores. It used to be big. They're still a $3 billion company right now. Used to be, you know, $25 billion, $30 billion in that range. Ford, obviously, was the, you know, Henry Ford built it, and the highest point was like over $100 billion, close to $100 billion at least. Now it's like, I believe it's $15 billion. So if you're looking at Ford, their debt-to-equity ratio is like 5x. So their company's worth $15 billion. Their long-term debt obligation is like $75 billion. These companies, they're iconic, they're whatever, you know, they hire a lot of people, whatever. I'm not just calling out Ford specifically. I'm sure with more research I can find more, or this one might not be accurate, but the point is, companies have to go bankrupt. They have to let hell come to this religion that's called capitalism. Second is that if all the tools, they will be able to help, yes, but they are risking something else that ultimately money printing brings, is that the dominance of U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. If they keep doing that, and because they did that in the past, everybody, and here's the thing, I'm very neutral on this. I'm not actually bearish on the dollar or bearish on U.S. economy or too bullish or whatever.
Okay.
People have done it in the 70s even, saying the death of the dollar is coming. People have done it in 90s. People have done it in 08, saying this is the time, this is it. Somebody else is going to replace this.
This is the end of the dollar.
Yeah, people
talk. They were saying that? Okay.
Yeah, they've been saying that 4 or 5 times, you know, in the last 40 years. So
okay.
Every recession, they say it already. But was because every time U.S., at the end of the day, this comes down to GDP productivity. If productivity comes through, basically, say it in more simple terms, what is productivity? If the next Facebook, the next Amazon, the next Tesla, the next SpaceX, the next, even or Spotify from Europe, let's say the next Square, the next everything, the next Zoom even, right? Or the next Zencaster. I'm sure the Zencaster from U.S., actually, the one we're using for recording podcasts. The thing, if it's from the U.S. and it's creating productivity, by productivity meaning producing profit for shareholders and producing employment for employees, right? For people, right? Because these companies hire a lot of people. So if these companies come from the U.S., U.S. dollar still will be the most dominant. There's just no other way around it. Doesn't matter how much they print. Even though, I know, it looks like a very gangster kind of behavior that just, like the Fed is like, gangster, I know. Because they basically kills the other countries during recessions and helps the U.S. They do that over and over again. But as long as the best companies, the best, productivity that U.S. economy produces here, then that would mean. However, there's a risk of if that's not here, then we are looking at a different world from a currency standpoint. So I would say two things about basically regarding your question, like next time the crisis comes, what's going to happen? One is that they have to listen to from punk companies go bankrupt. I think they will, though, because they're at the end of the day, they try to be very, very helpful. And by the way, the Fed did the job in March. I'm not saying anything wrong this time because it is a different crisis. But like they try to be helpful, but they are rational people as well. At the end of the day, they realize some companies can't be saved, so they let them die, then they die. And that's a good thing, right? There's restructuring and new players come to the industry. Bad business models get rooted out, right? That's a good thing for the economy. If they let them do that, and if they don't go excessively money printing, they will certainly do some. Trust me, they will do some. But if they don't go excessive and the U.S. economy comes back, then they will keep the dollar as reserve currency. Otherwise, that's a risk.
I see. So do you think we'll be in a low interest rate environment in the next 6 years, decades? It's like before 2026 comes.
Yes, I think. Whenever they raise interest rate is actually when the problem will come, yeah.
I see. Mm-hmm. So they probably wouldn't do it if they can clearly see that, right?
Right, but if the inflation runs very hot, they have to do it though.
I see. Yeah. So essentially when the next recession hits, printing more is probably going to be the first weapon they go for. And then essentially going back to your previous point, productivity becomes the key to how the U.S. recovers or the world recovers from the next recession.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly. Yes. Let's say even just use the COVID crisis, right? There were certain industries getting hit hard. Things were pretty dire, during that spring we just had, right? But guess what, though? The part where the money shifted, Zoom made a crazy amount of money, right? You can look at, I'm sure you've heard their latest earnings reports. Yep. Their earnings up 3,000% from last year. 3,000%. They're at a 96 billion valuation now, right? 96 billion, like bigger than IBM already. Almost $100 billion company. But guess what? It's somewhat justified. I'm not saying the Zoom stock is a buyout, but by the way, I'm just saying, guess what? The valuation is somewhat justifiable because they're going to make $2.5 billion next year in profits. So like it's not like they're not making, it's not like it's all hype, you know what I'm saying, right? Even though the P multiple is still high, right? It's like 55 times or whatever. But I'm saying, they're still pulling in cash though, like to their bottom line. They're making profit, not just promises. Okay. So with that, and then with COVID, like Amazon's making a ton of money from COVID, right? Apple had their best quarter for quite a while. So I'm saying during a crisis like this, it doesn't hurt the US as much because the best performing companies during the crisis are still U.S. companies. Eventually, these companies are distributing that to employees, to their partners, and reinvesting, and therefore the cycle goes. You see where I'm coming from? But if there's a cycle where U.S. get hit hard, which like this one, they get hit hard, but the recovering piece isn't even their companies, then we got a problem. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So, But okay. But to also echo on a concern I raised yesterday regarding the first piece of our episode was that I do think there's certain part of industries that are getting hurt very hard, very bad, and those things won't recover quite a while, and that's going to have an impact. Not saying we're coming out of crisis yet. I know we're talking about the next one already. With that, like, you know, clubs, bars, big gatherings, event gatherers, CES, you know, Eventbrite, you know the company Eventbrite, right? It's almost bankrupt now. Short sellers are squeezing the crap out of it. You know, it's like, it was a, what is it, like a $6 billion company, now it's only $900 million. You know, they shorted the hell out of that thing because, yeah, there's no events right now. We use Eventbrite. So, right, there's no any gatherings or museums or whatever. And then, there'll be like concerts, Coachella, things like there are industries that are getting really hurt right now. It's going to take a while for them to recover, and some of them will die. So this one is going to take some time. And then the reason why I don't think it's going to happen in a year or two was because, you know, it's still robust. It's still robust coming out of it. Like, once there's a vaccine, I know it takes time. Lots of people in the U.S. don't even believe in vaccines, which is very, ignorant in a way. Anyway, the point is, you know, eventually, when things are okay, there will be a spending. People are going to go to Cancun, spring break will resume, sports games. People haven't been to a sports game in a while. They want to go again. They want to go to concerts. All that pent-up demand will happen. Like, and you just think about from a perspective that the first Super Bowl that's going to allow fans, the first NBA game and the first Coachella or those things, you're going to see people's going to go, right? Because they waited for it. Even the people who weren't going to go, it's going to become a popular thing. That's how human psychology works, and they will go with their friends, and because it's just certainly become a thing again. Finally, oh my God, everybody who watches social media talk about it. So that kind of pent up demand. And then again, commuting, finally people back in the office, stuff like that, then, you know, people be out and about and moving, and that brings, you know, all kind of Uber, oil spending, all that kind of stuff, spending airports and hotels. So I'm saying that will be continue the robust comeback for certain sectors in 2021, 2022. That's what I'm saying. The productivity should be okay compared to this year. But I do think longer term, the industry that have structural problems will be exposed whenever interest rate goes higher, and they realize the real estate loan they are not able to make their principal payments, or if they want to get new ones, they can't afford that rate. So that's basically my prediction. I don't want it to come true, but that's the. I really think that's something that's high likelihood is going to happen. Yeah.
I see. So you mentioned the inflation and its relationship to the Fed's raising rate or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's your what's your outlook on inflation in the near future? There's been a lot of discussion about that.
Right. I'm sure you've heard
of it. There's one party saying, you know, since the Fed is printing so much money, obviously inflation is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are others that, you know, look at 2008.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of conversation about rising inflation, which didn't happen, at least using the way we measure inflation right now.
Yes.
So what's your outlook on this on this topic?
And you know why, and your explanation didn't happen was because technology innovation, right?
Sorry?
And you know the reason why it didn't happen after 2008, the people used the reason to, the big number one factor to explain that, why supposedly lots of QE, lots of money printing should happen.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen. It was mainly because of technological innovation, right?
Yeah. Okay. Increased productivity.
Before you are spending $25 on an album to buy your favorite artist, you spend $80 every year on listening to your music, but now you're spending $9 a month on Spotify. Things like that. You are everything so much cheaper. Technology innovation was the biggest reason. And this is mainstream views. This is not just my opinion. This is the consensus.
I see.
What's the reason after 2008 it didn't have inflation? Because it makes everything more flat. You see what I'm saying? Like shitty.
I see.
Yeah. Literally in Chinese, it's shitty ping. Yeah, because things are, because before, imagine you go to the library, search for the books and all that cost and stuff. Now you just go on Google, find your stuff. And email is free. Like communication is free. Phone bill gets less and less, right? The Wi-Fi is like $70. You everything's good. You don't need cable anymore, right? Radio, people stop paying for radio. Like you know, just things. So many things are free. So that's why
cheap.
Yeah. that's basically why it didn't
work. Okay, so basically, it comes back to productivity again, right?
Yes.
So,
yes. So basically, coming down to productivity again, where, okay, if you can drive down cost, then the businesses don't want to raise prices to scare away customers, right? But when they're unable to drive down cost,
okay,
then they
probably... You mentioned the cost. So, follow up, how does the new... how should I put this? The new protectionism and the deglobalization come into play, because a lot of people are saying that that's going to cut into the margins of businesses, U.S. businesses, right?
Yes,
that would happen.
Yeah, that is the inflationary force. That if companies are forced to make things here or in developed
countries,
then they will be able to. They won't be able to maintain their margins when they're globalized, and they have to raise prices to maintain their margins. Yes. However, I think that's a little bit different topic because it has geopolitical things to it. I do think I'll jump back into that main core part of the inflation in a second, because I think that's more important. Kind of put it to bed and don't really worry about it from the deglobalization part.
Okay.
You know what though? It's mainly rhetoric. Like Trump says all this crap, and then companies don't do it though. Nike aren't moving their factories back. Apple's still having, you know, like the Taiwanese guy, what's his name, making his all the Apple.
Go Taiwan.
Apple's not building a factory in California though. Like no matter what Trump says, right? So all those crap don't happen. One. Second is that it is possible to move out of China. That's a real force. But guess what? There's Vietnam. There's Thailand. There's...
I see.
You know what I'm saying, right?
I see.
There's Mexico. Exactly.
It's the Chinalization. It isn't really globalization.
Yes. Like Apple will probably move some part of supply chain, diversify or whatever. Mm. And when Nike gets too much critical pressure, they'll go to Vietnam or whatever. But like... They are not the factory in California. They're just not doing that. Like,
I agree.
They know it's the death of their product because there will be too thin of a margin and they can't charge the higher
price.
And then
it makes a good political slogan.
Yeah. So that's why I always, every time I hear those things, I joke about them. I sniff. I'm like, oh, this is not gonna happen. You know, because really, the companies are making the decisions. They're not doing that. So
I agree.
So
makes sense.
They're not.
Okay, let's get back to the inflation. What were you gonna talk about?
Yeah. So the main inflation part, which is interesting, that's actually has a to each of his own. We're trying to intellectually analyze it. No one can tell the future. I certainly can't. You probably have a better insight since you read a lot. We'll see how it goes.
No.
Here are my 2 cents. And also, by the way, to add something else, is that just like my idol Warren and many others, Seth Klarman, Bill Ackman, all the standing drugs, all these guys, I'm a bottom-up investor. So I look at company fundamentals first. Then look at the industries and study businesses and trying to find attractive businesses at a, good businesses at attractive price to get in. So I'm not a top-down investor, so that how I look at the currency situation in the world or geopolitics doesn't really impact too much into my investments decisions, just to let you guys know.
Got it.
Yeah. But back to let me try to do the macro part of it. Is that because the trades I make are on companies, they're not on, let's say, do the euro go up or the Brazil currency goes down, or I'm betting commodity prices coal prices going up, where you're saying, right? Those are different type of funds than the funds. So
more macro kind of funds.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So but looking at a macro point of view, here are my 2 cents. If we are able to keep the cost down for technology innovation, I do think a lot of inflation should be at bay. Not as in the hyperinflation, because I think we talked about this in previous episodes, was that just to refresh that 1988, 87, those 19% inflation, about 16, actually no one knows the exact number, the CPI, whatever, 15, 16, but 19% federal funds rate, where you can put your money in the bank and get 19% annualized interest. So, I mean, if the bank pays you 19% risk-free in a savings account, no one invests. I mean, just who does that, right? because it's safe, right? Yeah. Who cares if stocks pays you 23%? You get 19 in the bank and you don't invest in stocks, right? So that was the time with just actual hyperinflation. Now, I don't think that scenario is happening, okay? Because the continued technology innovation where it drives down the cost, right? Let's say only 5 years ago, only the luxury makers, like if you sell like 65 grand, 80 grand level cars, like Mercedes-Benz or upper level BMWs, you can squeeze out like about 12 to 15% margin, gross margin. And Tesla's able to sell 40 grand cars at 25% gross margin. Why? Because most of their factories, are automated, right? They have robots making it, less engineers. They don't need as many people, right? So, obviously, versus internal combustion engine, electric cars it's actually cheaper to make. So, examples like that. And before, you have to actually have places, and literal things for you to store all your data and stuff like that. Now, everything runs on a cloud. You build data centers, but data centers can run for years. You basically purchase something from Azure or AWS or Google Cloud, and basically your entire operation companies runs on there. So it's cheaper that way, even though it's a recurring revenue model, but it's good for these companies who are providing the cloud, but also it is good for the customers as well. It is better for them. Before you, like Amazon Prime, you're paying for $100 a month, a year, right? But everything you do are 2 days and stuff like that. So you actually spend less time like going to parking and buy stuff at the mall, stuff like that, and then they just deliver to you. But like cost is almost like nothing. So actually, you're getting the same kind of goods, but you're not paying much. So these kind of things, these kind of innovation, these kind of things are, or digital advertising, right? I think this is something you're familiar with, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have a huge budget to run any starting businesses, right? Because just even 10, 15 years ago, you got to put some ads on TV. If you were cheap with your budget, you put some on newspapers, right? Magazines, right?
Yep.
But they're not effective. I don't think they cost, it's not like they're super cheap. They still cost, I think, at least today's Instagram ads rate, right? So to put on newspapers and probably more, and magazines, right? And TV, and you're talking about other, there's not many other platforms. And so the cost running. So basically, I'm giving only a tip of iceberg there of how cheap these days costs are for many businesses to produce their goods and services. So I think that's a deflationary force. And you can literally, it sounds like you're very interested on this. I recommend, highly recommend, you can just Google like technology space deflation, deflation or the deflationary on Google. You'll find articles written by experts on how technology innovation is creating deflationary force. It's very intriguing to read. Yeah, I highly recommend it for our listeners.
For sure, I'll check it out for sure.
So then you will see exact force I'm talking about. These articles will be able to articulate better than I just did. I'm just giving you some kind of examples.
I see. I'm bringing this up because in one of our previous conversations, I remember you were suggesting to me privately to move away from cash to more assets in the next decade due to inflationary pressures.
Yes. Yes, that's the key.
Do you still hold the same?
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's what I was getting to. Remember, so as we said, we move back to mean inflation talk. So the hyperinflation will happen. And I do think 2%, 3%, like higher than now, is definitely possible. I think even 5% then the Fed has to move. And by the way, my prediction on that corporate debt bubble bursting, right, was because there is a 0 to 1%, 2% rate. I'm saying if we move to 3%, 4%, some companies are going to die already. So that's how dire it is.
Right.
I'm not saying Federal Reserve, the interest rate were at 22% in 1987. So because the inflation was too hot, they just put it at 22%. Stock market dropped on October 2nd, 1987, dropped 25% on that day. That's called a Black Monday. And it was because Federal Reserve decided we were going to shut this down, so things are good price. Like oil at the pump was going up like 10% every day. It was crazy. So like we're going to shut this down and everybody's going to this is the coolest economy down or whatever. Because the actual goods prices are going up too much. So my basic consensus is that we're not going to stay at 1 or 2 though. The too low of inflation, we're making 3, 4, 4, 5, whatever, and then some companies will die. That's why where I kind of have that prediction of the corporate debt bubble bursting and stuff. So back to what you were saying with the asset allocation, that's the core piece. Which this is the sad part, not sad really for us because we're in
the sad part.
This is the sad part. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
we have two kinds of inflations. And one is often talked about, never happened, like you said, after 08. That's the core CPI. That's good inflation, right? Literally oil at the pump, your food.
Yeah, I remember reading somewhere that they've changed how they measure inflation.
Yeah, yeah. Right? But they track basically all that, like your water, your pork, your beef, stuff like that, right? Milk, okay.
Okay.
And the second part of the inflation is the biggest ever on record since 08, and it's continuing to get bigger. That's why I recommend you privately with that asset allocation strategy. What? This is asset inflation. Asset prices inflation.
Okay.
So you can look this up as well. It's called asset price inflation. So after 08, they print all those money. Good services prices didn't go up. People wonder, where did inflation go? Where did all that money go? Guess where? Financial assets. Housing prices went up. Stock market prices go up. Bonds become more expensive. Mm. Anything with a yield, gold prices goes up, right? Gold at all-time high. Everything goes up. So in financial markets, because guess what? If you are the closest source to money, right? Or let's say people, who are just two kind of people. Let's say a fund who's trying to allocate, like pension fund. We talk about that. Let's just say high net worth individuals. If you already have money, let's say just call it $30 million net worth. I reached the number because that's the market's hard for 0.1%. 1% in America is 10 million. Right around 10, it was 8.6 million 2 years ago. Now it's 10. It goes up fast. 1% in America is $10 million net worth, and 30 million is ultra high net worth. It's the 0.1%. Okay. So 0.1%, 30 million people were up. If you have that, do you really start a business the next day and try to hire people, try to make people actually do, especially, generation two, second, or the third, or whatever, they don't do that. You allocate it the right way with the 60-40 equity bond portfolio, or do whatever asset allocation. And you have many allocations, right? Because you're at that level, you can get many good deals, right? Many private investment deals, many things like that. You 30 million, you make 5% a year. That's $1.5 million. 5% a year return. Mm. 2% a year, right? That's like 70K. Yeah. You spend all the interest without touching your principal, you live a pretty damn good life.
Yeah.
Right? You live a good life. So nobody wants to risk $30 million. Do they actually put $30 million into a company that's going to make rockets and burn it all? No. Like, or they're going
to... Other than Elon. Other than Elon.
That's why you should be treasured. Yeah. So these people should be treasured. Mm-hmm. Like, or you're putting something into a Pixar and try to make some cartoons, like Steve Jobs. No, like, you don't try to make some cartoons and...
A logical person wouldn't do that.
Yeah, logical. You already made it. You don't do that, right? If you already made it, especially. Because I used the Pixar example and the SpaceX example was because Elon made it. It was $200 million in 1999. And Steve Jobs made it was like $75 million or like $120 million or something. It was like $120 million. Mm. 96 when he joined Pixar. $120 million, you don't just go do cartoons. You can do something, you know what I'm saying, right? But anyway, those things could... People could not watch your cartoons and you just burn it all because he put in his own money. So so the point is, rarely people do that. And most people, stay put and they live a wealthy, very, very, very high quality life. Yeah, very good life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the asset inflation where it goes. And what's the number result of that is wealth inequality. It's social inequality. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The more money you have, the more money you are going to have if you allocate it correctly, have smart brains to do it. And most people who are wealthy, they are not dumb, and they talk to smart people, and smart people talk to each other, and here we go.
Yep.
Right.
It's a more extreme divide.
Right. So
essentially, the rising asset pricing, it's the floor has been raised, essentially. It isn't just a bubble. The floor has been raised.
Yes. Oh no. It's not like a bubble has kind of faked, like, you're gonna burst it at some point kind of
Amazon, the floor has been raised.
Yeah, like Amazon isn't a bubble. It's rated at 50 times this year's earnings, 90 times next year's earnings. Because there's more money being printed. It's not overvalued. In the 1980s, with that limited money supply, right? I can send you a chart, by the way. This would actually be good. We have had a video to put a chart out, like a PPT or whatever. Is that money supply?
Maybe we can post a link. Post a link in the description.
Like the Federal Reserve, the balance sheet, like the money they printed before 2008 was $600 billion. $600 billion. After 2008, it was $2.8 trillion. Okay? After COVID, it's $7 trillion.
So essentially, the advising asset pricing will be even more dramatic than post 08.
Much more dramatic. Already happened.
It's gonna be crazy.
Already happened.
I mean, yeah, with the stock market, we're already seeing that.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. Okay, I see.
Yeah. So let me drive that point home real quick. Just, you know, the private. I'm so glad you brought that up. Was that I'm you know, now publicly. I would like to basically, you know, send that advice again. Is that you have to allocate. Because if you want to stay at where you are relatively to other people's wealth, right? Because 30 million, let's say if it's 30 million, you don't allocate, then what the problem is that you have that paper wealth, but it's actually, you know, as years go by, especially us at the, you know, sort of still early part of our life, even though, you know, we feel aging day by day now, but, you know, our future is still longer than our past, right? So, 40 years later, for the ones who are super conservative, only staying in cash. You have to understand, cash is the cheapest thing in the world. It worth nothing. People can, especially the Fed, they ka-ching, print again, ka-ching, print again. Do you want to own something literally people can reproduce easily? Or, okay.
Limitless.
And this is Ray Dalio's point. I'm directly using his words, and which was brilliant, was that he's saying money has two usages. One, medium exchange. You use it to buy other things, right? Second, storage of wealth, storehold of wealth, right?
Yep.
Okay, so if you hold all cash, just assume someone who's as dumb, you know, just hold all cash. So let's say I know you already allocate, but let's say advertise, I have to advise that person to allocate all cash. You think, okay, I have those, I just hold it. What's, you know, if I allocate, there's risk in stocks and investments and whatever in real estate events. Okay, so then my thing is, so you think cash is storage is the storehold of wealth? Then if they can chain print it again, okay. Then ultimately your relative wealth, you know, compared to the 90%, he's still probably fine, but your relative wealth to those people who allocate is diminishing. Then therefore the goods you can afford ultimately will be less. And second is, which one is able to produce a share of Amazon? Okay, one share of a excellent company. There's only a finite amount of them, right? Would you say it's harder to create a excellent Fortune 500 company than Federal is to start a printing press? It's obviously harder to create a good business, right? So therefore, that's why the stock price is going up and the valuation is going up, because the price we put on a good business is even more precious in the times of crazy amount of, you know, currency, because currencies are cheap and high quality resources are less. That's basically why Maotai goes up year after year, and Amazon also goes up year after year, because there's more renminbi, more dollar, but only one Maotai. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, going off of your point, moving cash to assets seems like the obvious choice, but between different asset classes, you mentioned scarcity as a big factor in determining storage of wealth, right? Storehold of wealth. Is there a difference between different asset classes? Some that are better as an inflation hedge, some that are worse.
I would say the best are the ones produce more cash, right? So an asset, imagine if it has cash flow, right? You buy a house, you buy an apartment in Shanghai, right? I think we talked about, like, you rent it out. If it collects you 5%, it's better than a apartment collects you 2%, right, annually. Assuming the prices don't change, you're assuming the, you know, it's a good asset, stable, the price doesn't hijack it anymore. It doesn't fly, you know, like the old, like the 90s, you know, or the early 2000 Chinese real estate. So assume it doesn't move, right? But the one produced 5% is better than 2%. So then the better cash flow it brings, the more valuable the asset, right? Because your asset, the only asset you're buying actually produces more cash, where you have your own cash flow. You don't have to rely on the Fed clink, ka-ching, then you depreciate. So then the ones who can produce cash flow are the best, in my opinion. And those are company ownerships. But I don't mean that to visit in public traded companies. If you have a private equity investment, you have a VC, you have an angel, like any kind of good business produce good, well, then you own a piece of that. I mean, that's great. So assets who produce more cash flow. That's number one choice. Second to that is scarcity value. Let's say a piece of Manhattan real estate certain amount of gold, even though it sounds ridiculous, it's just yellow metal, there's no use to it, can't even eat it, can't do anything with it, but it has 2,000 years of history, right? Gold has 2,000 years of history. People do somewhat give it value. During war times, it's, you know, people, you can transact with it, even though it's hard. So, certain part of real estate, precious metals like gold, and if in the future we adapt to some sort of cryptocurrency that's not a mean currency, but you know, it's people recognize its value. Let's say even if long term, like Bitcoin value is always at $10,000, then it eventually goes up by the limited supply of it. And if more people want it, then if it stays at this point already, so I'm actually a moderate, you know, crypto bull. I think I think Ethereum and Bitcoin, at least these major ones, or the ones who are network effects like Compound or Chainlink, I did some blockchain work recently, like, you know, with the ones who have, you know, actual utility value, like Chainlink, which provides infrastructure for like the Oracle in blockchain, then it has value. Then these things, they have scarcity value and they're limited supply. You can't just continue make another Bitcoin. So, then these things have value as well. So the second is scarcity. But the first one, the best, is our businesses who can produce more cash flow.
I see.
Yeah.
So based on what you just said, can I interpret it this way? Since gold doesn't produce any cash, would it be not wise to move all your money in gold? It wouldn't be the wisest decision, right?
No.
That sounds like sounds to me like good real estate property is much superior to owning or ownership in good companies.
Yes.
If you can make the right decisions, it's much better than only just precious metal.
Oh, I agree. Real estate is better than gold, in my opinion. Yes, good ones. And companies are even better. Absolutely. Because real estate considers an operation, right? You got to have people sometimes fix the water pump, whatever, and then for your renters, if you rent
it out. More work to it.
It's cost, right? But it's a cash flow business. Basically, if you're running a real estate, like a renting out place, if you're running a leasing model, right? So it's a property management. Then you own real estate. They rent it out for people who need it. It doesn't matter, residential, commercial, whatever, right? So there's operation cost. And there's operating cash flow, then you divide that, there's net income, then you make money. So that's just like a business. Yeah. And also, if you are good with your insight and your vision, the place happens to be more people desire to go there, then the price goes up as well. You get a price appreciation. So
I guess the only downside would be liquidity, I guess.
Yes. Right. The only downside is liquidity. Exactly. You hit it. You already financed the efficient out of it. Exactly. The only downside is that you do have to consider the transaction speed and easier to transact. You know, at times when you really need liquidity, you want to be able to use it at that readily at that point. And and that's something, as another asset class, cash, even though we basically criticize a bit, that's something I do think people still should have allocation to cash. I'm just saying, you know, for people who can't be all cash or 80% cash, because cash is the asset class people should hold as well. It has what? It has a guaranteed future loss, but it provides ultimate liquidity for all things you need, such as on March 23rd, if you had tons of cash, you make a lot of money if you wouldn't use it, right? So cash is definitely something to provide liquidity. So I would say the ultimate, you know, my version of, or, you know, I'm sure this is not new, but let's just call it Robert's portfolio. I would say you want to allocate a percentage. I'm not going to give it like exact number. I think everyone's different. But I would say, you know, number of priorities, you want to have businesses who produce cash flow, and most of them are available on a stock market. If you aren't able to invest in one privately, I think you can invest privately in people who own business. That's great. And by the way, the risk in the companies owning the stocks or whatever, I look at it the same thing, is that they only become bad investments when they suck in cash. Imagine if somebody runs like a very declining industry, like a Xiangkang industry, right? Then that's worse than cash, or worse than even gold or real estate, whatever, because you have to put in cash every year, loses money. You see what I'm saying? Like, you have to put in money every year to make the factory run, and then at some point you gotta stop, right? So that's the opposite, you know, sort of a bad business would be that kind of investment. It's worse, you know, if you're doing that, then you're better off just don't invest at all, right? So anyway, companies who produce cash flow, real estate, because they have scarcity and can produce certain cash flow, then certain scarcity alternative currency, I call those. Gold is an alternative currency, maybe 1% or 2%. Cryptocurrencies are alternative currencies. Some of them have usage. They definitely distribute ledger technology in the future, can disrupt many things, right? But so maybe 1% or 2% allocation, I do think it has value. Certain amount of allocation to cash.
Got it.
Yes.
So how do you view Berkshire Hathaway's decision to hold so much cash and still hold so much cash? I know they recently made a move into gold, but it's still such a small amount, right, compared to their cash store.
Yeah. Great question. So
how do you view that?
Because Berkshire is the...
You're making a mistake.
Yeah, it's the golden standard everyone looks at, right? Glad you asked.
Yeah. It seems contrary to what, you know, a lot of other people like you and Ray Dalio are saying, right?
Yeah. And it's the textbook. And here's the thing. Maybe because, these are some news are a little bit more recent and a little more secondary. Maybe you haven't caught them. Actually, let me give you some news update. These are just happened in the last 2 months.
Okay.
Sure. Berkshire Hathaway. Then we can talk about what's their approach, okay?
Yeah.
The conclusion I'm getting is that Warren is actually looking at this and he's moving, you know, sort of Ray Dalio or my way, sort of this way, actually.
Okay.
Talking much more cash now. So a couple of things. On March, you know, he had a record like $160 billion whatever allocation. They have so much cash on the balance sheet because they made so much money before, right? So, and they start allocating now. A couple of deals they made, right? That gold position is actually very small, and they didn't buy gold. Actually, they bought a gold company, right? He doesn't buy the currency.
Gold mining.
Gold mining company. It was a 1.29% position in his equity portfolio, even though it's like a couple billion, but, you know, to him, it's just 1% position. So, anyway, so it's not that big. But they made a $10 billion deal, okay, out of his $160 billion. But $10 billion is still reasonable size. $10 billion deal was Dominion Energy. They bought the entire East Coast natural gas supply. Just a huge... Every winter, they run heat. Like, you were in Vancouver, you run heat as well, but imagine the Toronto side of things. Like, the natural gas supply, not entire, but the major part of that. I don't mean entire, but there's some, you know, smaller players. But Dominion Energy has the main part of it. And Berkshire bought that in a very good deal. Mm. That company is the one I'm talking about, like, that's struggling now. Hard for them to make interest payments now on their bonds. So they had to sell part of their assets to make the company smaller. Okay. So, and they sold, and Berkshire bought that. And that fits into his entire energy landscape. I think previously I mentioned Berkshire Energy is actually quite big. It's about, $70 billion, the entire business. I think at this point, over $100 billion already, and out of their $500 billion market cap, so it's like 20% of their business is Berkshire Energy. They provide, when you go to Vegas, I think I mentioned this, they provide all the electricity in Nevada, in the state of Nevada. That's mainly Vegas. So the entire strip, think about how good a business that was. I mean, obviously got in like early, like I think in the 80s or 60s even. I'm not sure the exact year actually. It was before we were born, of course. But, you know, he got into the utility business, and in Vegas, the lights are on all the time, right? 24/7, all the time. And it provides electricity in Vegas. I mean, think about how durable of a moat that is. Doesn't matter which casino or hotel is doing well. He's giving you electricity, you're paying. So anyway, and actually, Energy owns the biggest wind energy, not solar part of it. Solar, there's a couple other places that have solar as well. The wind energy in the U.S., they own the biggest part of it. So they transform a lot of farmland into wind, okay, and some of it into solar now. So Berkshire Energy is big, and that $10 billion allocation, that's one. So he spent some of that cash. That was in June, by the way, like early June. July, he spent more of the cash, okay? He bought five, I think you heard about this, he bought five Japanese companies that are trading companies in Japan at like 8x P. These are companies, let's say, they were, basically they are goods and services, like say, they, you know, like those containers, those huge container ships at the Long Beach, like they transport all of them, you know, like from China. There's lots of goods coming to the U.S., right? Long Beach, like in L.A., it's a huge port. Like there's tons of, they're doing COVID. Every container is like mask, all from China, you know, like there's huge, you know, because a lot of people doing that business, whatever, that's the basically the port of transportation, okay? So the five companies he bought in Japan are total about $6 billion in putting separately in each one. And then that was those kind of companies in Japan that in terms of for Japan's international trading companies. And I think my interpretation of that bet is that he thinks U.S. dollar will weaken. And the second biggest currency in the world now, it's yen, actually, because euro is being declining quite a bit. Euro is weakening, which is third. So yen, Japanese yen actually has risen. And then he's thinking, you know, Japan will have after 20, 25 years slump. I think the economy is still the third largest economy in the world. So he thinks there might be a bounce there, and those companies are very good bet on Japan. And also, the fact that he holds those companies in yen might yield him actually some interest, some exchange rate return on the dollar when he comes back to the U.S. as well. So that's, I thought it was a smart play for full disclosure. I'm around Sony. I think the video game industry has a long way to go, and Sony is a good. So I like Japanese companies as well, and they are well run, and they're, you know, Japanese people are just they know what they're doing. So and typically they're the corporate culture where people, you know, work pretty hard, and they have lots of technology innovation there too. So the point is, so he's putting money into Japan. Then this week he allocates, this is smaller size, but a $600 million into an IPO, but the first IPO he's ever participated in since 1958, into Snowflake.
Oh, wow. In
the storage, you can look at it, Snowflake IPO, you know, Warren Buffett, you can just find a name, you know, it's everywhere. This week, just happened 2 days ago on Wednesday. It's a data storage company. Basically, it's a company solely run on cloud, right? And all companies, they store and they analyze. They don't provide the direct analysis, but they run their data through Snowflake, and it's sort of a unicorn company that were valued at like $12 billion, you know, when they're even private, and they went public. And, you know, big Berkshire got in, and the valuation went crazy. If you tell me the numbers, you probably won't believe it. You know, it was it was $12 billion. Earlier this year, doing their B round funding in the private world, and when Berkshire decided to invest, their IPO at $33 billion. On the first day, it went to $66 billion, and the company only has $400 million revenue last year. So they're trading at like about 120 times their revenue. Yeah, it's quite wild. Yeah. So, but the point is,
Do you think it's possible that these are not decisions made directly by Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger? Do you think it's possible that the successors are making these decisions?
Yeah. His successors, Todd Combs, Ted Walsh, those guys. I really think so. Yeah, I think especially the Snowflake with the tech company one.
I see.
I don't think that's in Buffett's.
Right. It just doesn't seem like their style.
Yeah, it's not their style. But the Japanese ones, yes. The what was I going to say? The energy ones, for sure. Yeah. So. The natural gas one, for sure. So, yeah, my point is, he has allocated about 15 to 20% of his cash. Yes.
So okay.
Basically, out of $160 billion, he spent about like 25. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Which he said he wasn't willing to do if he doesn't see any indicator of the economy have any, you know, chance of coming. In May, he said he wasn't willing to do that. But now he... A month after, he bought the $10 billion purchase of the energy of the natural gas pipeline. And then he bought $6 billion to Japanese companies. And then he bought some stocks on the markets as well, a couple billion. But then he bought the Snowflake IPO. And also, add another point is that Berkshire definitely does not underperform. And Buffett, I don't think he lost his touch, because think about this. 44% of his equity portfolio, 44% is one stock. It's Apple. Since he bought it in 2016, it was $165. It was $520 before the split. Like, he made a 2.5 times return in Apple in like So his biggest position in bet was not
44%. 44% of his portfolio is in Apple.
Yes, because it grew so much.
Whoa.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I didn't know that.
And another stat, shocking, ready? Apple pays a 1.2% dividend yield, right? Like a tiny dividend yield, but, you know, reasonable for a tech company, right? So, but because Berkshire owns so much of it, every year, just by dividends, Apple pays Berkshire $800 million every year in dividends.
Jesus.
Because Berkshire owns so much of it. So Apple, you know, 1.3%, you know, that's it. Because Apple's at $2 trillion now. Berkshire owns like, what, 6% of Apple? So $2 trillion, you do the math, they own 6% of it, they own like $120 billion of Apple, and then $120 billion, 1.3, yeah, they pay like, you know, about $1 billion to Berkshire in dividends.
Wow.
Yeah. So that investment being successful. Yeah. And 44% is the worth of that. Yeah. Well, it's kind of sort of like my Tesla investment was, I mean, on a much smaller scale for me, of course, but it became at the highest point because Tesla went up 9 times since I bought it, literally 9 times. So about 3 weeks ago, it was about like 65, 70%. Then I had to cut it and stuff. Yeah. So.
I see.
Yeah.
Got it. But anyway, I mean, in this, yep.
Yeah.
Go ahead. What were you saying?
No, I was just saying, anyway, I'm saying Berkshire allocating some cash. Yeah.
I see. Mm-hmm. So we're touching a lot on how they the stocks they picked. So in this new environment, was your new new confidence in the previous prediction you've made?
Mm-hmm.
How does this affect as an investor your how you analyze companies? Like especially I guess the debt structure. Right? Mm-hmm. How do you look at it? Does it make you avoid certain kinds of companies and favor others?
Absolutely. Yeah. It makes me favor companies who don't have too much pension allocation, bond allocation. Makes me favor companies who are on a lean model, who doesn't have any debt. We can mention you probably already know. I'll mention more, but you already know, Tesla is one of my favorites because it doesn't, it raises $5 billion like last week by new share offerings. And all of a sudden, they erased most of the debt. They raised at this point this year, they raised $15
billion. By new share offerings.
Yeah, because
existing shareholders?
It dilutes the existing shareholder by 1%. Yes.
Why would they opt for that?
But because it
seems like an odd choice.
Because demand is so high, people want to buy it. So the stock price, it's just demand. You know, it is so crazy. I do think it's overvalued, but for the moment. But the fact that you can raise cash easily, to risk $5 billion basically is out of thin air, right? You just produce more shares, literally just boom, right? So then your long-term debt obligation is minimal. And now, actually, they become the most asset-light automaker and the least, only have least amount of debt now, their debt-to-equity ratio versus, say, GM or Ford have to pay, Ford pays their shareholder 7% dividend yield. And what they suspended now after COVID because they can't afford it. And eventually they have to resume dividends and they still have to pay their interest to pay out, but it's tough. So anyway, companies like that or a company like Spotify or Square who have no long-term debt, like Spotify has zero debt, or Chipotle has zero debt. Chipotle is at 65 P because it's growing at, 12, 15% a year still, same store sales. Every year grows at around right around mid-teens, 12% area.
Still wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, people love it. And they open new stores, their digital offerings good. So they have delivery and then digital, you order it on the app, you go into the margins, being able to be good. And because they're automated process, right? Because mainly they sell for their fresh ingredients, stuff like that. So they actually need people to make it and, the server, whatever. They run a very good fast food restaurant chain model. I'm not even too much of an expert to explain the actual detail, but the way they run their kitchen and stuff like that, they over squeeze high margin. And they have no debt, no debt. And Spotify, no debt. These kind of companies, yeah, definitely. And for companies who have this amount of debt, if they are able to generate, if their industry is a rising industry, if they have a moat around their business, they have a temporary hit, and in the future, they can repay their debts, and they can make, therefore drive earnings growth, and that's not a problem. I'm definitely willing to invest in them, like Disney. Disney has a decent amount of debt because they bought the Fox deal a couple years ago, many years ago, they bought Marvel. Those those cost money, right? That's why those capital allocation decisions have to be made thoughtfully, is that Disney could be a huge company now. This year, they could have bought TikTok. We all know about that whole saga because
of
order and stuff. It was Disney is all about kids. It's such a perfect fit if they just dropped $40 billion. They had money last year. Disney had the money to buy TikTok bang. But because they bought Fox and they bought, all kinds of stuff, Marvel and stuff like that before, they took on already enough debt. They had to suspend dividend this year too because COVID hit their parks and they're making way less money now. 40% of the profits still come from their theme parks. So they can't buy TikTok at this moment. So first, their future growth. But either way, I do think Disney will come back and their streaming, their Disney Plus service. I'm sure you already heard about Movie Mulan. They charge $30 per movie. And you have to pay $6.99 a month, stuff like that. So they have DTC, they have the direct-to-consumer model, they have theme parks will come back. I really, I think both you and I can agree, in a vaccine, corona-free world, people's not going to avoid Disneyland. People are still going to go, right? There's a moat around it, right? There's no, easier maybe to create a social
brand, the IP.
Yeah, it's naturally easier. Yep. Maybe easier to create a new social media app that people love than harder to create a world, just a dream land for kids that parents have to pay $170 or something to get in. Like Disney, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
The moat is so strong. It takes so much for them.
And especially in today's world.
Yeah.
And then there's no challenger. nobody's thinking about how to create a competing product for Disneyland.
You're right.
Except for Wang Jianling.
Yeah.
In China.
Yeah.
He thought of that, but didn't succeed.
Yeah, he didn't succeed for Wanda Group. Yeah. And they own AMC Theater, and the theaters are like broke now. So
yeah.
Exactly. So that kind of business, like, that's fine. Disney has some debt. That's fine. So those kind of businesses that are okay, or the ones who can recover well. I've been looking to Mexico airports, like the one in Cancun, ASR, the one, you know, Grapo, PAC. These, you know, airports businesses have a huge moat businesses. Even they have some debt now. But the fact that flights gonna go over there again, we don't know which airlines. Some airlines might go there. Perhaps some airlines can last. But the airports will. It's another big moat businesses, right? People still have to fly through those airports. And the reason why in Mexico airports, which is only because, you know, U.S. airports are public traded, you can't, you know, like, you know, buy shares of LAX and stuff like that. But if you could, you can imagine LAX long-term economic trajectory is the same, right? It has way less revenue now. It probably still loses money now, LAX. But for the longer term, aviation is here to stay. People want to go to places, and LAX is a good business. Same applies for airports in Cancun, airports in Mexico, things like that. So those are the businesses that we'll be looking at into. And to answer your question, on the how does it change me look at businesses, I think the biggest thing is that can't be fixed on valuation multiples. Like, if a company like you like at, let's say, 25 times PE or 3 times revenue or whatever, or PEG ratio or gross, like EBITDA, you know, all of those, there's thousands of valuation metrics. Do people have to take those into grain of salt? Those are like more like I call like tactics, like shu, you know, like the philosophy, the Dao, is that where you pick up like from Peter Lynch, from Warren, from these people, like in the 90s, yeah, Peter Lynch wrote his book, like, you know, One Up on Wall Street or Beat the Street, those two amazing books. I've read both, like, you know, he's saying if the company's over 35 times PE or like stuff like that, that's fixed. That's because he was, you know, he wrote that in 1991, right? You can't take that culturally applied to today's world because the money supply is different. Like I said, you know, there's so much money, so much, you know, paper currency now. So, but you have to look into what are fundamentally attractive businesses. So, like, only Amazon doesn't
have
too much of a second thought because of their moat around their business. And I'm not too worried about paying for a, you know, close to 90 times PE. And best example would be back to Tesla. Would be last year had no PE, right? It was losing money. But that does not impact my decision to be able to decide to invest.
So, I see.
Okay, because
you no longer look at multiples when valuing companies.
I look at relative multiples.
Relative models.
Yeah, like say Spotify is at 4 times revenue versus Netflix at 11 times.
Okay, so I see. Comparing competitors.
Yes, so like I would say I think audio has a long way to go. And a huge runway to get close to video. So a 4 times revenue on Spotify's valuation, I think, has room to go versus 11 times on Netflix. You see what I'm saying? So I do relatively. But, or let's say Snowflake has 120 times revenue. That's insane because there's a phenomenal, you know, data storage companies trading at 20 times revenue. So then that's too much. What's their moat? How can they deserve that much, right? So I have to look into that. It's all right. That's why it's hard. It's so hard because there's no formula. People, it's not physics. People look for a formula and then you figure out things.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's yeah.
In that case, it would be too easy, right? Everybody could become the next Warren Buffett.
Everybody will be, exactly. Right? Or let's say Tesla doesn't make money.
Formula you can implement.
Yeah, or he's at 100 times PE now, but GM is only at 20 times PE. Then what does what Tesla do deserve a 5 times more than GM's multiple? You put it, then, you know, everyone goes through all those advantages again. Then it does. If to you it does, then you decide to do that. And that's basically how. Or let's say Sirius XM, right? Who is Pandora now? Do they deserve? They are cheaper than Spotify. But what Spotify does, the business model, do I think it's worth more than, let's say, 20% more premium than SiriusXM? Hell yeah, I think it's like 3 times more, right? So then you put a streaming service over a radio. You know what I'm saying, right? So that's basically, you have to think about how that's actually going versus Yeah, versus, or let's say Chipotle versus like KFC. KFC are 20 times PE, Chipotle are 60 times. They both make fast food, one Mexican, one fried chicken, who cares? But no, there's actually many things they're doing differently, and Chipotle deserves better multiple, you know, so.
Mm.
Yeah.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it seems like we are in a period of change.
Yes.
Great change this year.
Great change.
Everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The economy, how you invest,
yep.
Right? Asset allocation. On this episode, focus on finance economy, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I guess these two fields would have had a greater, greatly impacted, right?
Yep.
By the pandemic.
Yes. Yes. Because I don't want to understate how severe that was. If Fed didn't do that, then we would be in a different world right now. So because they did that, now creates challenges for investors and capital allocators and decision makers. Yes, but these are in a way good problems to have because they did help with the situation. If the federal government. You know, what they did was the stimulus checks, right? With the $600, with the over-support, right? The economy would be lagging a little bit, or much more, right? So that's basically, and the world, because you know how China and U.S. and these big countries' impact on the world economy is. I mean, imagine if U.S. got, I mean, this is not a domestic conversation, this is an international conversation, is that it's going to impact the world. Imagine if U.S. consumption is down, then people who make all those things in China not gonna have the same kind of revenue for those companies. People who rely on trade with US like Japan and Germany gonna have problems. This whole thing. So basically, yeah, it was heroic what they did. They saved the world, and that's their job. But that does create new problems. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
True. So you think they made the right decision.
Yes, the biggest one still is wealth inequality. It's just people who own financial assets gets wealthier faster.
Mm, yeah.
As simple as that. Like, your asset prices growth, it's higher than wage growth. Like, let's say, after OA, right, S&P 500, just a simple S&P 500 portfolio, just, you know, by the market, by the ETF,
yeah,
produce 10.9% return. Do wage growth, or do people really make 10% more every year compounded on their salary? No, the wage growth, the actual number was 2.4%. So basically, the people who own assets had five times faster growth, but they already are rich. So that's the wealth inequality.
So I guess the more governments around the world adopt to money, resort to money printing whenever faced with economical difficulties, the more income inequalities we will see in the future.
Yes, because closer you are to money, you can leverage more. Yes.
And it seems like more countries are going to be in a low interest rate environment for the foreseeable future.
Yes.
That, you know, this is just going to be, we're going to see more printing in the future. And this is going to be a trend that's going to be with us for a long time.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
So for individuals who are, let's say, less fortunate to be in the that situation, then the thing to do is that own as much assets as possible. Save, invest, right? Buy more stocks every weekend, stuff like that, right? Every week, every Monday, every Friday, and then buy some crypto, buy some real estate. Take out leverage when you can, get a first mortgage, buy the house, take on the loan, work hard, pay for it, but the house price will appreciate. Then, you know, collect some, you know, just do, you have to basically turn that into assets, yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. And I guess for this trend to be reversed, it would take a huge boost in productivity, something like a new technology boom.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
To counter that force.
Yes, the ones who can create products and services better. I mean, like Jeff Bezos coming from a very very lower middle class family. Right, there's people, you know, Ray Dalio's from his dad's a jazz musician, mom's a middle school teacher, like, you know, people, Steve Schwarzman, the founder of Blackstone, came from a very, very middle class average family. His dad runs a laundry machine business in Philadelphia. Things like, there's success stories. I mean, people can still create something for themselves. This is not an excuse this is actually just Charlie Munger's wisdom, is that, try to be a survivor of your situation, not the victim. Because everyone has a situation. Everyone has the quote-unquote situation. I got a situation. He's got a situation. Yeah. Be the survivor. Don't be the victim. You know?
So, on
the individual level, individuals have to do. There's definitely more opportunities, and entrepreneurship is the greatest one. And there's no doubt. Number one, you can change your life that way. Second, if people who can't are able to go from zero to Jeff Bezos or to there's many people in Silicon Valley be able to sell a company for like $10 million and do well and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Second route is work hard and save and invest, and then to let your money make money for you while you're sleeping. And to go along with that asset inflation trend and then to profit off that way. So, yeah.
I see. I guess this goes is kind of diverse from our today's topic, but I'm seeing that with this trend to continue, we'll see more income inequality, and it'll push the world towards greater, I guess, geopolitical conflicts, internal or external, for countries around the world.
Yes.
And perhaps we'll eventually have to face another reset like we had in the 1940s, 30s, right?
That's the biggest worry, I would say. Remember I said what was...
That's longer term.
Remember I was the bottom-up investing and then, top-down things. That's typically doesn't worry me. I don't bet on this country doing that currency going off next month or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the biggest one I do think about quite a lot. If eventually the conflict, internal, external, cannot be resolved, then the whole world has to be reset.
Yeah.
So basically, the reset, think about just in China, right? The reset was that, people, before that, it was sort of capitalism, to you own the assets, you get better, whatever. Then the reset in 1940s was that, okay, the wealthiest country before is not the wealthiest country after, right? Okay, England and, Germany becomes America.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the country's reset, right? The big boys, like the actual country's reset.
Yep.
Small boys, like individual level, like China's like 地主, landowners, they are become the bottom part of the population, right? All of a sudden, 1950s, Mao.
First to reset,
Mao's like, F you guys, you guys are the worst. So they could become...
Reshuffle.
Yeah, reshuffle. So they become like the highest class of the people, Jiang Jieshi's wife, Song Shisan Jianmei, those highly educated people. They were able to run to Taiwan, but like I'm saying, most of those who stuck in mainland, right, the high class people, who own lands and stuff like that, they are despised and they become the bottom, right? So, and China had a reset in the 80s where, like, when our parents went to work and stuff like that, there's no social class. Everyone can achieve your dreams, sort of, right? If you put in, if you have a vision, drug business, put in your work, whatever, right? So then sets a class now, then moves forward. Like, America's sort of the same thing, right? Like, after the 40s, you reset. Yeah, so, Warren Buffett was born in 1930, perfect year, right? In the World War II ended on his 15th birthday. He went to work 5 years after 1950, right? He graduated college in 1952.
Yep.
At 22 years old, 1952, what a time, right? and he's 1960, right? I mean, there's a one-man success. I think most people to achieve moderate, a decent level of success and, individual efforts, the environment, all things have to do with it. But to achieve... century generational level success, there has to be some basically big tailwind behind it, right? So he was born at the right time too. So anyway, the point is, I think at our time, especially, let's say you have another 60 years to live, cannot do that out. 60 years is quite a long time. I don't want to run into a situation where in our middle of our life, 40s or whatever, there's a reset. Then that's the time to really think about to hedge tail risk, like black swan level of risk, right? Like maybe open a Swiss bank account for some gold in there. I don't know, but there are things that, if U.S. China has a war, and then your U.S. account things could be frozen. I'm just saying, reset is definitely a long term. You touch right on.
Yeah.
Long-term, the number one worry of mine is that complete reset of world order, and that people have to be prepared for that. Either you can thrive after it, or at least you survive, but don't become a victim of it. So basically, I'm saying don't become the landowners in China. On mainland, they had to, like, if they knew, they had to run. You gotta go, man. You just gotta go to Taiwan and sell your stuff. And you can't stay there and have the, farmers coming and then dig you grave. Right? Like, you gotta go.
Yeah.
That's my point. You know, like you got, or the Jews, like, you know, there's many, I'm sure there's many other scientists that other than Albert Einstein, but he decided to leave. Einstein was like, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to get out of Germany. This is the time. Right? So I'm saying those that individual decisions have to be made at historical moments, and one has to have enough wisdom and I guess sensitivity to smell that and to make the decision to basically have one's fate to be decided by themselves, not by others.
Yes, yes, very well said.
So this is something definitely so some kind of nuanced the way I'm doing where we seem to be comfortable now, but you know, should always be.
Yeah, I mean this is nothing to worry about in the near future.
No,
but something to keep in the back of our head.
Yes,
always in the next 20-30 years.
Yes, especially because I try to remind you, because it's not something to worry about in the near future. Just that's the danger of it, right? That's the danger. Because if the danger is something that can happen next year, people are alert already.
But everybody can see it.
When you and I were so comfortable at 51 years old, when something happens, you're like, oh my God, right? So that's where it
is. Yeah.
Well, 43 years old. Well, 35 years old. Who knows, right?
Who knows? At least 10 years away from now. So within the recent 10 years, I don't think we need to worry about a huge reset. Yeah.
I hope so. I hope there's no war. If there's a war, then regional conflict even. I hope so.
In our today, everything's accelerated world, maybe it will be faster too.
No,
conflict will happen faster too.
No bombs in North Korea, no bombs in South China Sea. Taiwan.
I'm seeing that. I guess if there's a huge, let's say, another technological boom and productivity increases around the globe, economic output increases, it will solve a lot of these problems.
Yes. Right? Oh, yeah.
Including the conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. I love we use Chinese on our episode today. We use more. Deng Xiaoping said, you know, really, just people, the overall, because think about a pie, right? Yeah. If the world is not a zero-sum game, the markets, the economy, the overall pie gets bigger, the uneven distribution gets easier. Like, you know, it's always not the distribution is getting worse and worse. You and I both agree. The distribution is getting worse and worse.
Yep.
But if the pie gets bigger, it's a little better, right? Because people feel like, you know what? I'm going to have some too. You're going to have some. It's okay. Even 100%. Though relatively, you know, the rich still richer, whatever, you know? But overall, it's better, right? Or if there's class mobility, right? Like U.S., the real is still moderately okay, you know, bullish on the U.S. or even certain aspect of China, I think, you know, like, is that there's class mobility. Like, people can, it's hard, but it's doable. So maybe it's less
possible,
in the 50s, 80s, or 90s, but it's definitely still doable in 2020. It's not impossible. So there are definitely, I think I mentioned a couple of times that I talked to my friend in Russia, in Moscow, frequently, like once a month-ish, right? It's impossible in Russia. Mm. It's impossible. Like, impossible. There's no entrepreneur.
Impossible. Why is that the case? Is it the legal structure or the culture? What is it?
We're probably going to get into our podcast. It's just too tough. It's
Okay. Cool.
The country has like 23 rich men, and they own everything, like including Lama Puni, and all his friends. That's it.
Kind of similar to Japan, where a few corporations owns literally everything.
Yeah, but I think Japan is a little bit more, you know, like capitalistic than Russia. But yeah,
what I heard is the entrepreneurial spirit in Japan is pretty dire.
Oh yeah, it's crap.
Partially due to the culture.
Yes,
they don't have a good culture in accepting failures of other people.
No.
But whereas in the States, you fail, at least it means at least you tried, right? Hey, try again.
Yep.
Good job.
Yep.
In Japan, it isn't like that. You fail once, and then people kind of judge you forever.
Yes.
Or people don't support you in the same way.
Yeah. It's like shameful. Yeah. So.
Yeah. China. In China, study better. Yeah.
China study better. I don't think it's that bad. Yeah. Korea, Japan are pretty
bad.
Yeah. So, but Russia is mainly not really about the culture people don't respect. It's just the authority controls all the resources. They don't want you to succeed.
Consolidation of power, I guess.
Yeah. So. Right. So productivity. That's right. Everything goes back to productivity. Productivity. Okay. Then
if we have another boom like we had with like the steam engine, steam power, like that kind of a dramatic boost in technology.
Yeah.
And everything will be a lot of problems will be solved. Yeah. But will we? That's the big question, right?
Yeah. I'm optimistic.
I'm
cautiously optimistic.
I don't think things like the blockchain or artificial intelligence, even though these are big changes too, I don't think they're comparable to what we have with, for example, electricity or steam engine powered, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think those were bigger technological changes compared to what we are having right now.
Yeah, right? It's hard to say, but I do think it's hard to say. I think energy efficiency, if we can, you know, green energy, I think that's big. Also, you know, don't overlook the smartphone innovation, that the world is on your fingertips, literally, right? The world is on our fingertips. People access information. The world has become way more and more flat, right? Search engines, I think it's powerful. Even though those things are hardware, but I think certain software things are powerful. Like, I think we still overlook, like, how much Google changed our life. Just a search engine, I mean, just simple as that. But access to knowledge, the most powerful thing in the world, right? If you care, if one really cares, can spend 12 hours on Google and feel like he has the biggest library in the world and learns everything, if one's willing, right? So these kind of things, I think just different. I would say those are super powerful. These are powerful, super powerful. They're just different. So it's hard for me to say which one.
Compare.
Yeah. So
I see.
Like a different generation of athletes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So these things just might be more tangible. But yeah, let's see in the future what can we accomplish.
Yeah.
And productivity happens, we should be all right. Productivity stagnates. Bad politics, bad bureaucrats, bad, you know, diplomacy, and internal conflict, these things could cause more conflicts, and the conflicts at a certain point is going to impact everyone. Mm-hmm. Not natural. That's not like COVID. That's a different kind of crisis. That's a crisis that's like, I'm saying that's horrible because it's not the natural course, just, you know, random virus pops up, whatever, we deal with it. Not saying it's easy, but that's going to be harder because humans want to hurt each other in that case, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, no matter the situation, there's always a way to do better, right? To be better.
Yes. Yes.
Not saying in every situation you could be live your old, most optimal life, but there's always room for improvement.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's to kind of led to our next episode, I guess. We'll do that meaning of life. On JP was that he said in the rule 7.
Yeah. That would be a good transition.
Yeah, he said
for next episode.
Yeah, he said he's convinced me there's evil in humanity. What we need to do is provide a reason or a place for most people to do good instead of doing evil. He's proven there's obviously, you talked about before, why do so many Germans quality Germans become Nazis, stuff like that. There's evil in this world, and if you give people enough or no breathing room or enough of an excuse or reason, they will do evil. Mm-hmm. So
it's also mentioned in that book you were mentioning, Thinking Fast and Slow, right?
Yes.
People underestimate how much the environment influences their behavior.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can't emphasize enough. Do you feel you have a different, complete just outlook on life? If you live at a place long enough, let's say you've moved a couple times, you live in different, you know, places, houses, apartments, different cities. I'm just talking, let's take all those factors away. I'm just talking about only the home setup. If you move your home, like, your perspective, things are different. If you live there for long enough, like 3 months plus, whatever, if you live at a place, it changes your perspective, right?
Yes, it affects your life, yes.
Yeah.
Some people describe it as, you know, a certain kind of energy or getting into kind of a mystical kind of things. But I think it can be explained probably more scientifically, you know, the culture, your schedule.
Yep.
Perhaps the food you're eating or something has to do with that, the air. Perhaps biologically speaking, there's a difference.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think more has to do with your schedule, the environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I look outside my window right now, I see people on the street, crowded, kind of crowded.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to be in Vancouver, I look outside, it's trees.
Mm-hmm.
Plants, nothing's moving
much.
It's a very quiet kind of, and it definitely impacts your mindset and your state of mind.
Yes.
Yeah, I do feel that.
Yeah. Or you look out seeing the mountains, seeing the ocean might have a different result if you put that person in
long
enough, right?
Oh, yeah. I feel, Yeah, it's just a very direct kind of experience. I feel if I were to be in that kind of environment, let's say in Vancouver, I feel more calm. It's easier for me to sit down and focus and then, you know, drink some tea, read a book, be away from distractions. But if I were to be in Beijing or Taiyuan, where I look out my window and I see people on the street, I see so much going on, so much noise, going downtown LA.
You want to join that, right?
I want to go, make me want to go outside, make me want to, if I sit down and just sit here and focus, do something, I feel like I'm missing out on something.
Yeah. It
gives me that kind of feeling.
Yep.
Right?
Totally agree, man.
Yeah.
Totally agree. That's why, let's say when we were in that Big Bear Mountain Resort, that little cabin, it gives you, we were reading, you know, not we were reading before, but you know what I'm saying, right? One of those, like a mountain resort kind of thing, gives you the more time to be calm, to read and stuff, right? But if you're in Shanghai or New York City, 100%. Then you have a place like, you know, near the Bond in Shanghai. You look at it, just so crowded and busy, and it's so, the lights are on and stuff like that. You want to go out, right? Yeah. It's easier for you to accept a friend's invitation to say, let's go for a drink, you know, or go meet a girl, whatever.
Yep.
Versus in the mountain, you'd be like, go out to where? Where do you drink at which bar? Let's come.
Yes.
Talk at my place, right? That kind of thing, right? Yep.
Yeah. And then another layer is the people around you also influences you, right?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we have to be careful about choosing, you know, a place or choosing people around us, right?
Who's even more severe.
Because it has a...
I think even a person...
And this kind of influence, it's not direct. It's not really identifiable.
No.
It's slow and
but the
subconscious.
Exactly. But what's certain is that time and frequency. So if you're with that person in that environment long enough, frequent enough, impacts obviously, right?
Yeah.
But if it's short enough or
inevitable,
frequent, then it's less. But the most notable things for us in our life, for everyone in their life, is that those things are the longest, the most frequent. Your hometown, the partner you're with, the home most people live at that place for like many years, right? That those are things you don't notice, but they have a fundamental impact on who we are. Yes, absolutely,
100%.
And
100%.
I don't mind sharing some personal evidence on that. You know, when I used to date a girl who's more romantic, sentimental, like more poetic stuff, whatever. I'm more sentimental. I'm more romantic. I'm looking at my sunsets more, do whatever those things. It's nice. I'm just giving one side of it. There's other side of it, right? When I'm with my current partner now for a long time now, she's way more scientific. She's definitely more faster paced. And she's more mission driven, like, you know, get things done and boom, 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 do this, do that, what's next, and, you know, task driven kind of thing. We have less time holding hands, look at the sunset. I try to implement that, but that's less of our culture, stuff like that. So I have a different personality. I definitely, I was 50-50 neutral on 50% romantic, sentimental, 50% rational, getting things done. Then now I'm definitely 70% more of anything is done, 30% romantic, right? Because of what I'm with for so long, and that I realized that, you know, recently that had a profound impact on me. Slowly, that becomes part of me, right? So, people are, you know, you live with our friend Leon for quite a while, and, you know, roommates have those impacts. Yep. Other people, you know, just different. And then when you're not with them for quite long enough, those things might get out of your personality or leave you. But I think with the time, stuff like that, it's definitely part of our life that's people definitely overlook. Yeah.
True. I think a lot of people also experience this when they first move away from the parents. Right, they live with their parents for the most of their life, and then they, all of a sudden they move away for a year and they change a lot. Mm-hmm. I personally experienced this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I lived with my mom for under the same roof for a long time, and after I moved away from her after 2 years, I realized the sort of change. I had a shift back to my my old self, or influenced by my friends, and then I was able to see the differences, the influences she's had on me. Those some are permanent, but certain things are fluid.
So that's and for the last couple months you lived with her, I kind of revert back to some of those habits, right? That's why we're complex individuals, human beings, because, you know, we have many different sides of us. We are
yeah, and each individual, some are very I guess solid and not stubborn, but stable. It's almost like their most stable sort of physical structure.
That's why
they don't get influenced easily. Some are more influenced easily.
Yes, right? Yeah, to different degrees. Absolutely.
And it's double-edged sword. The ones that are more influenced easily, if they're around, you know, negative people, they become more negative. If they're around positive energy, they become more positive.
Yes.
Right? So it's a double-edged sword.
Absolutely. Yep. And just like, you know, Jordan Peterson said that, I think there's another rule was that, you know, be friends or close with people who want the best out of you, right? And Warren Buffett said this as well, be with people who basically be friends with people who are better than you. You know, I think most of my friends, me, including you, I try to at least find things, at least they have certain qualities that are better than me, because what happens is that you be with them for a long time, you become more like them, right? If you want to have worse endeavors and behaviors and things like that, being with people worse than you, what's going to happen? You're going to be more like them. You like it or not. You might have a sense of pride at the beginning, a little bit ego. Like, you know, definitely I can relate to it. When you sometimes hang out with people who are worse than you, you know, they're like, they're definite in many ways, like at least the core piece, the quality ways worse than you. Then you might enjoy that for a little bit because your ego, whatever, stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you know, like it's not going to help you any good because you're going to become more like them if you're with them quite a lot. So that's
yes, and it's not a good path to go down.
No.
Yeah, I've seen people that enjoy that a lot, and then just surrounded by people that are, you know, in most ways, worse. It's kind of like, I don't like to classify people into different classes. Seems a little judgmental, but, you know, if we were to rank people based over overall scores,
absolutely.
You know, some people are surrounded by people that are low and feeds their ego, makes them feel good.
Yes.
And it's not good.
Yes.
It's not a good psychological reward system.
No.
It produces longer term bad outcome.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they might be some kind of pleasure, you know, sort of feeding to their own insecurities that they feel like they're better than someone else. But longer term, it's definitely not a good thing.
Especially for like a CEO or founder of a company, because that means the founder is hiring people that are below him, that are not as talented as he is, and that's a huge problem.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
So and I think. For to summarize that up, is that you want to be people that want the best of you, their intention's good, and you want people that are better than you, at least in some ways, so that they could actually, you can improve your endeavors while you're with them. Otherwise, it's counterproductive.
Yeah.
So with that,
all right.
Wrap it up and move on to the to our next episode, which we'll kind of tease everybody about. Be, I thought I'd have some new, after summer 2020, with that new thoughts on meaning of life. And I'm sure Roy has some new fresh thoughts on those things as well. And we can share that. And this transition was seamless. We did it now. Longer than we said we're going to do. We're going to do 40 minutes of the second part of this episode. We did 2 hours. As always, we under promise, we over deliver with quantity, with the length of the episode, at least, maybe not with quality. But
quality too.
Yeah. This is something Wall Street analysts always want the CEOs to do on earnings call. They want them to. They want to say like, it's okay. Like, we might grow 10% revenue next quarter, but they grow like 15. You know what I'm saying? They always want the other companies only. Then there's like a room for like share price appreciation. You know, like, but for those people, but they're not used to people who actually overpromise. Okay, sometimes on the deliver, Elon does that quite a lot. That's not a good habit, actually, ever since he's been CEO. Then share price goes down. People go, oh, this didn't happen, that didn't happen. But at some point, Elon says, you know, I'm always late, but never not make it. You know, I will always make it. But when it happens, people are like, wow. You know, it's like, that's like traditional CEOs actually do under-promise, over-deliver. Like, under-promise a little bit, and then surprise a little bit, you know. So, we definitely under promise on the time, and we over deliver on time. But you know, like I said, quite good. So yeah, we did that was quite a bit. Finance, markets, and inflation, asset allocation. Hopefully, that's technically it's helpful for people. And I mean, just my two cents. We'll see how that goes. And which I think more importantly is that we talk about, Roy brought up the point and started with that, the book Think Fast Slow, talk about how environments actually change who we are. And we talk about how environments change us, physical environments or people we're with. And I think people is much more important in that sense and stuff like that. So, overall, I would say it's good to be back on RZ 2 cents. It's been a month. That's,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Hope everybody have a good week.
Yeah.
And look forward to our next episode.
Yeah. If you're in a busy city, you can go out like Roy and enjoy some mid-COVID, this new normal kind of fun. If you're in China, you wear a mask, so that's even better. So hopefully it gets better soon.
Yep.
We'll see. I do think it's going to take us some time, and even with the vaccine. So we'll see.
Yep. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Sounds good. All right. Okay. Thanks.
Yep.